And now it's time for wait a minute. What the hell is the show called again?
It's Chatter on Books. What else do you want me to say? Can I go now?
That's right. It's Chatter on Books. Let's do this thing.
Yes, indeed. Let's do this thing. We're back in studio, and this is an exciting show. We have a book report. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, completed and done by the outstanding pupil, David Aldridge.
March 25th, 2019, yes. Episode 17. Good job, David.
Yes. Not only that, with the start of baseball season, it's really...
Perfect timing.
Yeah, it's really upon us. Like, the season actually started last week in Japan,
yes,
with the A's and the Mariners played.
Which doesn't really count.
No. Well, it's domestic opening day.
Yes. So we have Jane Levien, who has written some amazing books about some really important baseball figures.
Really important baseball figures, including Babe Ruth. And you say to yourself, even if you're not a huge baseball person, you go, well, what else could be said about Babe Ruth?
Exactly.
Well, this book, The Big Fella, Babe Ruth and the World He Created, and seldom is the subtitle, is that what we call that in a book, a subtitle?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Seldom is a subtitle as accurate as this one is. This is a lot about his childhood, which is remarkable,
yeah,
and weird and everything. But the time in which he came to fame, and his fame helped the rise of sports journalism. The rise of sports journalism helped, mm-hmm, the fame of Babe Ruth and these others. Really remarkable.
Sports agents.
Catapulted
sports agents into the limelight.
Yeah, it's fabulous.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a couple other things on tap. We have David's much anticipated book report,
which
I'm looking at. I think it's 6 pages, single spaced.
Look at that.
God bless you,
David. Complete with citations.
Look at that.
Sure. MLA.
Sure. My God.
You've already gotten an A in my book.
There you go.
Just on volume. We may or may not do a segment on books that should be movies. We may not have time. And instead of deserted island recommendations at the end, we're going to do deserted bedstand books, because I've got a bunch of them that I need to talk about and just get off the bedstand. Everybody, again, I need to thank Claire, who was keeping the Chatter on Books, the Facebook Chatter on Books community going.
Thank you, Claire.
Thank you so much. Doing
keeping
a really
us in
terrific
wine.
Job.
That's very important.
Yeah.
Well, she's updating everybody on the books we talk about. She's updating everybody on the wines and the cheeses that we do. And thank you to CW, Calvert Woodley, our wonderful sponsor.
La Cheeserie.
Mm-hmm. Over at CW today. And Michael, I've got to get out the email here because Michael sent me some notes and I talked to Bill over at the store today. But David, Jeannie, you want to comment as I look this up?
It's very good.
Well,
it's
really good.
The cheese I really like a lot. It is salty and kind of grainy.
It's Argentinian, right? It's the Zuccardi family owns the Zuccardi winery from which this came, the Santa Giulia. It's a Malbec. Mm-hmm. And as Bill told me, it's a medium body, yet somewhat complex, which helps it work with a variety of different
medium body
foods.
And complex.
Medium body and complex.
It's very good. And Michael, who is the world traveler. I never knew this about Michael.
This is Michael Sands.
Yeah, Michael Sands.
Steve Sands' brother.
Yeah. I love Michael.
Michael's great. We love Michael. We like the whole Sands family.
Yeah. Okay, I just know
doesn't
Michael.
Doesn't he do like stand-up comedy on
yes,
the weekends?
Yes, he does.
Yeah. It's very confusing to keep throwing around my name like this. I appreciate the attention.
Michael Kornheiser's head keeps snapping around. Michael Sands visited this winery in Argentina last year, and he says it's one of the most beautiful wineries he's ever seen. And I'm thinking to myself, Michael's been around the world. You look this up. The architecture of this place is spectacular, but that's really good.
Does it have some of the spice we normally associate with the Malbec?
Yes, it does.
A little bit, but it's not too much, though.
Our little oenophile. And this winery, the Santa Giulia, is named after the owner, Jose's daughter, Giulia. And they came over, and then the Zuccardis came over from Italy many years ago. I did not know this, but a lot of Italians, World War I, came over to Argentina. The wine is something that they created because they wanted something that reminded them of home.
Mm.
It's lovely. And we don't have enough time now, but someday I will tell the story of the great cheese swap that occurred with one of the caterers to the stars here in Washington, D.C. It involved a Parmigiano Reggiano. It was great.
That sounds like a book that should be a movie.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's a book that should be a movie. But if you go to CW at 4339 Connecticut Avenue and give them, at checkout, you give them the promotion Chatter 5, you will get $5 off your bill.
How great is that?
Which is a wonderful thing.
Yeah. Yes.
And they really, every time I go there, I start calling my husband, I call my friends, I go, you have to go to this place. The most informed people who work there, wine, beer, liquors, La Cheeserie, of course.
Of course.
The nicest people, biggest selection. It's a fabulous place.
It's a neighborhood institution.
And a very nice guy who sort of monitors the parking lot.
Yes. Which is quite.
He has to chaperone the parking lot.
That's
actually
a nice way of putting it.
Yes.
It's a very nice way.
There's some drivers who should have their licenses revoked trying to pull into that parking lot.
Yes.
I did see somebody in there once speaking a language I didn't really recognize, arguing with somebody in in the store about his car, and it was very clear that his car was not supposed to be parked there because he wasn't a customer, but he was fighting it. Okay, David.
I'm going to finish my wine.
There you go.
One flew over the cuckoo's nest.
By the way, the great thing about this is, first of all, it's done, right?
Yep, right.
And now you get to point your finger at the next person.
Exactly. Right. Yeah, it over.
But who a little lead up.
Who
we
might be sitting next to my left. I'm not sure.
Mark, remind us why you chose this book for David. Is this book report?
Well, I really loved it. I remember reading it in high school and loved it. And obviously, I've seen the movie a number of times. And I just thought, and I love Ken Kesey, and I think he's just one of those great American authors. Yeah, really interesting. Obviously, I love The Grateful Dead, and he has some ties to them. Uh-huh. But I gave a choice. I remember it was that or All Quiet on the Western Front, mm-hmm. and you went with this.
Yes, I did. Not that I didn't like All Quiet.
That's more laughs, mm-hmm. I think. It's a real comedic
now
novel.
That is a bad movie. Have you ever seen All Quiet on the Western Front?
Which one?
Movie?
The remake with Ernest Borgnine or the original?
No, the one with, the original, I think. Black and white.
Black and white, yeah. Back in the 30s?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not very good. It's a brilliant book, but it's
goes
not.
Goes on forever.
Don't be killing Borgnine. Nobody chewed scenery like Ernest Borgnine. Yeah. You ever seen Ray Willard? It was awesome.
David, do you need a page turner?
Nope, I do not.
Okay.
I have a finger. I'm going to do it.
So thank you, David. Yes. Thank you for. Yes. I hope you enjoyed
it. I'm going to read. I'm reading now for the next several minutes.
Okay.
And what follows are more observations than a traditional review, but this is what's going to go on. The narrator of Ken Kesey's novel is a Native American known as Chief Bromden, his surname coming from his white American mother rather than his father's side. His father was an elder in the family tribe, which was set somewhere in Oregon. As the book begins, Bromden is in a mental hospital in the Pacific Northwest, perhaps not all that far from where he grew up. Having been there for some time, he doesn't say for sure, but it's surely been years. He is a large person who is thought to be deaf and mute, as he has long ceased speaking to his fellow patients. He is neither deaf nor mute, but he fears throughout the book that if he speaks, having actually heard many things over the years that administrators and personnel wouldn't have said in front of him had they known he could hear, that he would be punished. So he keeps up the charade. Kesey returns to this theme throughout the book, and I think it an analogy for how this country's majority population treated Native Americans after taking their land, warehousing them on reservations, and not listening to their concerns or their complaints about their treatment. Bromden recalls later in the book that his initial reluctance to speak came when he was a child after his father's pleas to remain on their land were ignored. The federal government wanted to build a dam on their property and ultimately was successful in doing so by forcing his and other families to take the government's financial offers.
Pipeline.
Yes. For years at the hospital, Chief Bromden had acquiesced to taking medications that kept him sedated for long stretches and produced hallucinations. He refers to the infrastructure of medicating the patients at the hospital as the combine, speaking of it as a living mechanism that produces a figurative fog through which the chief cannot see and in which he grows to be comfortable. Being constantly medicated keeps Bromden from being able to feel. Throughout the book, he notes that the other patients in the mental hospital are unable to genuinely laugh. The protagonist of the novel is Nurse Ratchet, or the Big Nurse, as the chief calls her. She dispenses the medications to the patients, but more importantly, she has complete autonomy over the entire ward. The chronics, as Bromden calls those with significant but treatable mental problems, and the acutes and the disturbs who are more permanently warehoused. It is an achievement of sorts to me how the chief and Kesey describes Ratchet and views her power. In the chief's telling, Ratchet is not rich and thus powerful, nor did she inherit her authority from a superior. And while Bromden speaks several times about Ratchet's physical attributes, she never intimates that she benefited in any way from her sexuality. She has simply taken control of the hospital. She has power over the doctor assigned to the ward and to other doctors who come in on consults. She has power over the other nurses. Late in the book, one nurse intimates in conversation that she doesn't especially like Ratchet or her methods. But Ratchet has control over her and the patients, not through physical force or threat, but simply with her manner. She smiles, but is not happy. She uses her smile as a weapon. She pits patients against one another in their weekly group meetings, which are ostensibly to help the patients get better, but are obviously designed to divide the group up and make it easier to control. Nurse Ratchet simply took her power honestly. And that is something that I think was quite rare for a man to write about a woman at any time, but especially in the 1960s, even as the nascent movement for the rights of women, particularly those of working white women, was growing. I was not as enamored with Kesey's portrayal of the African-Americans who worked at the hospital. The three aides who carried out Nurse Ratched's wishes and interacted with the patients were described throughout the book as the black boys, even though it was clear that many of them had worked there for years and had seniority. They are not mined in any significant way as to finding their own motivations and or fears. And Mr. Turkle, the night custodian, is described as easily corruptible and seemingly disinterested, both in the welfare of the patients and the hospital for which he works. Early in the book, we are introduced to the chief antagonist, Randall McMurphy, an Irishman who, unlike many of the patients in the hospital who have come there voluntarily, and who thus can leave at any time, has been committed to the facility from a prison farm in which he worked before. He is a self-described gambling fool that Bromden initially suspects only wants to con the inmates out of what meager possessions they have, money and cigarettes, through poker and blackjack. But Bromden soon begins to realize that McMurphy has other motivations. McMurphy immediately comes into conflict with Nurse Ratched, first over whether the patients can watch the World Series on television in the afternoons, then over other freedoms denied them over the years for one reason or another. He asks for a vote on the World Series and claims he has a majority even after Nurse Ratched insists he does not. He turns on the TV, but after she turns it off, he remains in front of the dark and blank screen in defiance. And soon, the other patients join him in an act of revolt against the nurse's authority. Bromden then begins to stop taking the pills prescribed to him at night and starts to wake from his years of self-imposed slumber. He notices the grounds of the hospital. He feels the chill in the air and empathizes with a dog sniffing holes in the grounds. McMurphy is quickly able to coalesce the patients from individuals sniping at one another's shortcomings into a group that seeks improvements in their living conditions. Slowly, they begin to change from the self-described rabbits they've been under Nurse Ratched back into the men that they were before their arrivals. McMurphy is the first person in a long time that seems to be able to outwit Nurse Ratched through the very verbal manipulations at which she excelled. Yet McMurphy suddenly stops agitating. Bromden discovers why. McMurphy has come to realize in discussion with another patient who'd been committed that the hospital can keep him there indefinitely, whether or not he's improving. It is not like prison, where you are sentenced to a finite amount of time and then released. Nurse Ratched could, if she wanted, keep him there for years and years. McMurphy is further discouraged when he realizes he is one of just a few of the patients who actually is committed, rather than being in the hospital voluntarily. As the other patients tell him they can leave whenever they want, yet choose to stay, he becomes disillusioned, saying, "I don't seem able to get it straight in my mind." But he rallies after Nurse Ratched says she plans to take away privileges from the group as punishment for defying her. McMurphy punches a hole in the glass wall to the nurse's station. It is replaced, and he punches it again. He then convinces the doctor on staff to let some of the patients go out on a day trip fishing, along with two friends of McMurphy's who are in the...
oldest profession?
The world's oldest profession. With the doctor accompanying them as a chaperone. The group goes out on the water and has a successful day fishing, but the joy is short-lived. Nurse Ratched again manipulates the others into believing they are merely marks for McMurphy. Even Bromden begins to believe it, saying to McMurphy, "You're always winning things." Soon after, though, Bromden backs up McMurphy when the two of them get into a fight with two of the aides, who are sadistically threatening one of the patients, who'd served as captain of the boat on the fishing trip. McMurphy and Bromden fight the aides off, but are punished by electroshock treatments. McMurphy, though, again gets the upper hand on Nurse Ratched by seeming to get through the shock treatments without going into the weeks-long days that the chief often had after just one session. The denouement of the book is an hours after visit to the hospital by the prostitutes, ostensibly to visit one of the patients, Billy Babbitt, who has a bad stutter and is thought to be a virgin. McMurphy arranges to pay off the night custodian, and the resulting evening careens out of control, with everyone getting drunk and trashing the floor. McMurphy's plans to escape with one of the hookers dies on the vine when the custodian falls asleep and fails to wake McMurphy in time to get out before the morning shift arrives. Ratched incurs her wrath upon her arrival not onto McMurphy, but onto Billy. He indeed loses his virginity, but she tells him she will inform her mother, who is also a master manipulator, of his actions. Terrified of his mother's condemnation, Billy runs into an empty room on the floor and kills himself. In response, McMurphy attacks Nurse Ratched, nearly choking her to death, and is lobotomized as a result. The chief realizes that McMurphy's actions, all of them, were for the group's benefit, even though it put him at risk, and that he himself was fearful. As Chief Bromden said, it was us that had been making him go on for weeks, keeping him standing long after his feet and legs had given out, weeks of making him wink and grin and laugh and go on with his act, long after his humor had been parched dry between two electrodes. The book ends with Bromden making a last permanent choice about McMurphy's future and his condition, and then himself escaping the hospital by picking up a control panel so heavy that no one believed any one man could move it, much less lift it, and throwing it through a window. Bromden, now finally awake, decides he'll return to his home in Oregon to visit old friends and to just be out in the country by a gorge that he enjoyed as a child. The book ends with Bromden saying, I've been away a long time.
Very well done. Wonderful.
Tear me to pieces.
It makes
me want to read the book about three more times.
Exactly. Again, so many things I missed the first 18 times I read something. That was amazing.
Yeah, please, comments, criticisms.
The one thing I do remember, and you talk about it at the very end, is sort of like the Christ-like figure that McMurphy becomes. Mm-hmm. And I remember specifically when they're on the boat trip, like they look at him and all of a sudden they realize how tired he is. I think there was a paragraph.
When he goes by and sees where he grew up, he takes them, drives them back, not on the countryside, but through the city, and he shows them his house where he grew up, and Bromden sees his reflection in the mirror and sees how scared he is and how tired he is, but that he, if you didn't see him, you would just hear him talking, and the bravado in his voice makes you believe that he's brave and strong and tough, but he's really just as scared as everybody else.
Yeah, and that stuck with me for these 30 years, you know, that description of him. And I just think Kesey's, I think is a terrific writer, and I think there's some amazing themes in there. You talked about it, the Native American, you know, how they're just ignored and how that's a big metaphor for that. He is less than stellar treatment of the African Americans who worked there. I think all of that stuff, it's great observations.
Yeah.
You get an A+.
The role of women at the time. Did you have one of the things we talked about last week, a lot of the criticism of the book and the play at the time, which Kesey shot down, was, oh, this is an exaggeration. Did you, with all the knowledge you have, and we all have, of places like that, did that occur to you at all?
No, it seemed to me that it seemed, again, for the book was published in 1962. I don't doubt for a moment that these things went on in mental institutions.
Yeah. Yes.
This is well before anyone thought that the mentally ill had not only had any rights, but certainly had any standing to be treated humanely and to be not just kind of put away and medicated and left to die, essentially. So, no, I didn't get that sense. I think it was such a shock probably at the time. And I know Kesey said, no, I actually worked in a mental institution for several weeks and months to get a sense of what it was like there. And so, no, it seemed very realistic to me.
And electroshock therapy was commonly used to just sort of obliterate extreme emotions of any way. I mean, you look back at the Kennedy daughter who was given electroshock therapy. And
was that Rory Kennedy?
I can't remember her first name.
I thought it was an M.
The oldest one.
I might have that wrong.
The oldest one.
Yes. But
Professor Kornheiser, any thoughts, comments, questions?
I think that was beautifully said. I would ask us to return to the text. We're at the end of part three to one of the sections that Mark and David were referring to. Then as he was talking, a set of taillights going past lit up McMurphy's face, and the windshield reflected an expression that was allowed only because he figured it'd be too dark for anybody in the car to see. Dreadfully tired and strained and frantic, like there wasn't enough time left for something he had to do. I think it's really important that we have the word allowed there as this role of savior is something that is put upon him. And he's removing this facade, as we see, not the true sense of self, but the reflection. We're all just seeing the reflection of McMurphy, and that's all he is at this point, is going to be just fragmented pictures of himself for others to use in this instance. I would also, just because I think it's really important, particularly for the marginalized group that that Chief represents here. We're on the bottom of 209. So this is in that discovery moment for him before he really is going to grow a lot under the light of McMurphy. And we have, I lay in bed the night before the fishing trip and thought it over about my being deaf, about the years of not letting on I heard what was said. And I wondered if I could ever act any other way again. But I remembered one thing. It wasn't me that started acting deaf. It was people that first starting acting like I was too dumb to hear or see or say anything at all.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
That's great.
Wow. Yeah. Great job, David.
Yeah, great job.
Are you glad you did it?
Sure.
I believe that was my exact response.
Quite a pause there.
Had you ever read the book in high school?
I hadn't read the book. I saw the movie, obviously. Yeah. And this is one instance. I mean, I remember Nicholson being great. I think the book is, I don't know, it's hard to say. I think the book is better in its portrayal of Nurse Ratched. I'm fascinated by how Kesey allows Chief Bromden to see Nurse Ratched. And there's almost, and it doesn't quite say it, but there's almost an unspoken admiration for her by the Chief. He won't come out and say it,
but I think
he really does kind of like her and like the way that she takes control and takes charge and doesn't take any prisoners and doesn't suffer any fools. And, fills the void that all of these men at one point or another in the book acknowledge they have.
Yeah.
Because they're all weak in one way or the other.
Well, and in 1962, there were very few jobs for women in which they could exert any sort of force or power. Nurse would be key.
Right.
One of the key professions where somebody, and if she ratcheted up, as they say, I mean, that's what you get.
Yeah, yeah. So that was kind of very cool.
Well, thank you for tackling. Who's
next?
This with such
good
luck. It's your call.
You pick,
and you pick the book.
Pass the baton.
Wow, what a who should I pick?
Well, I can't believe you didn't come in here knowing this.
Yeah.
Loaded for bear.
Oh, I know I'm going to pick. It's just a matter of the book.
Hey, Tori, how you doing?
You can come back on this next week if you'd like.
I will come back with a book, but it's on you.
Okay. All right. Again, I'm going to Photoshop my head onto Michael Kornheiser's body, and he will then do the report for me. Okay, we can throw this out for a vote, but I vote we skip the little segment and take a break and come back with Jane Levy and talk about her book.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Sounds good.
Yes.
Refill my glass.
That is a perfect call. Excellent. We'll get to that next week. Just to tease ahead, it's books that should be made movies.
Yes. Yeah. I have a great one.
Yeah. I do too.
So I can't wait to get to that. Yeah. But also cannot wait to get to talk to Jane Levy, who is right outside the studio door. So we're going to take a break. We're going to bring her in here. David, thank you.
Great job, David.
Thank you so much.
Way to step up.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Chatter on Books. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Chatter on Books. By the way, we didn't, in the intro, we did not say, everybody knows we're at Chatter.
Sure, we didn't.
Yeah. On the corner of Jennifer in Wisconsin. This is a for-profit business. Please
come by and support
our good friend Tony Kornheiser.
Yes. Monday nights.
Yes. Monday nights. To get trivia on Tuesday nights.
That's right.
And just for Thursday, opening day, there's going to be games on here all day, 11 TVs.
And then we got Sweet 16.
Sweet 16 in D.C. here this week. You got Duke, barely.
There's going to be great specials here. We were talking with Ron, the general manager here earlier. There's going to be some great things going on. So
Ron was telling me about how much beer was consumed over this past weekend.
Oh, I'm sure.
The answer is a lot.
Lots.
Yeah, a lot.
Watching the Duke game alone would have killed me.
So we're back for our featured author segment, which is sponsored by Calvert Woodley. Speaking of great beers, wines, I got a little fast fact on the cheese.
Yes.
By the way, David, you like the cheese?
I did.
So
it's very good.
I'm going to get, of course, another thing I can't pronounce. Reggianito. So this
just
was the Argentinians.
Reggianito.
The Italians who came over to Argentina, but they wanted something that reminded them of the Parmigiano Reggiano, the famous one. But these come in smaller. They call them truckles, but they come in smaller wheels.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very good. Again,
very
go to La Cheese.
Bread is good. Everything's good.
If you're not at Chatter on the corner of Wisconsin, Jennifer, then just go right
just
over.
Straight to Calvert
Woodley. Straight shot.
Get one of those trolley cars that just runs back and forth, back and forth.
Yeah.
So we're here with Jane Levy, who many, many listeners of this podcast, Jane, will know you, will have read you. Ron, the manager here, was going nuts earlier this afternoon talking about he's read every one of your books 15 times over. And we were saying before the show, this particular one, The Big Fella, Babe Ruth and the World He Created, seldom is a subhead, or whatever we call those things, so accurate.
That's right.
Because, you went after him as a child, which is not a lot of writers had done, but the time in which he became famous, and a lot of people and entities and organizations around him became famous and rose up, was pretty extraordinary. But let's talk about you first. baseball, sports, exactly. Baseball, sports in your DNA. You and I talked a little bit last week, but talk about your parents, talk about your family.
Well, my father was the water boy for the New York Football Giants in 1927, an important year in Babe Ruth's life and in the American century. And he got the job because his father, my grandfather, who I never met, Abe, was a bookie and a rum runner, and he supplied all the booze for the polo grounds. So
a great job.
Yeah. Got the job.
Those were the days.
And yeah. My mother hated everything about sports. So on their first date, he took her to a Brooklyn College football game, and she retaliated, setting a precedent for a 60-year marriage by taking him to Lohman's in Brooklyn, where the men sat in the high chairs while the flesh jiggled and behind the curtains. So, That's how it came to be in my DNA.
When you were 5 years old, did you think you were going to grow up and write about sports?
No, but my grandmother, when I was 5 years old, Celia Zelda Fellenbaum, lived two blocks, one very long, loud foul ball from home plate at Yankee Stadium, took me when I was 5 years old, and I did put on a dress for this, which was a rare occasion, and my Mary Janes, and she took me down to Saks Fifth Avenue on the CC train, which doesn't run anymore. And there was a mannequin in the window because it was opening week of baseball season, as it is now. And this woman had a Yankee jacket on, and her hands were out like this, very polished, blah, blah, blah. And she had a glove on her hand.
Wow.
And it belonged to a guy no one has ever heard of, Sammy Esposito. He was a lifer and a utility guy for the Chicago White Sox. I wrote a story about him and found him one day for the Washington Post when it was another opening day and we had no baseball to write about. So I went and found Sammy. And the first thing he said to me after, I told him that my grandmother bought it off the hand of a mannequin, telling the flummoxed salesperson, "I'll have that for my granddaughter."
I don't want the dress, but I want the glove.
I want the glove. I told my grandmother he was a Yankee after she got it. I had no idea who he was. But I told Sammy about this story, and he said, "Do you still have it?" And I said, no, my mother threw it out. And he said, "Gosh, I don't have mine either." Monty Tau. Everybody remember Monty Tau?
Mm-hmm.
Basketball player, yes, NC
very
State.
Short.
Yeah.
Very short. Had borrowed Sammy's glove for a softball game.
Oh, my gosh.
In which Monty Tau played with David Thompson, and he never got it back.
Oh wow.
How about that?
Hey, so, Tori, you went to North Carolina State,
right? Yes, I did. Thank you very much. Go Wolfpack.
Sammy Esposito was the head coach of North Carolina State from 67 to 87.
Of the baseball team.
Yeah.
And then he was assistant AD under Jimmy V.
How great is that?
Wow.
How great is that?
So were you a tomboy?
Yes.
Yeah? Were you good?
Yeah.
Oh.
Come on.
Yeah.
I mean, I threw out a ball at Yankee Stadium last fall.
Nice. And you got to home plate?
Well, sort of.
Yeah.
I actually called Sandy Koufax for advice, and I said, "I got to do this, and he says,
"Imagine
just stop for just let's just hold on that comment for a minute."
I called Sandy Koufax for advice,
and he said, "How far can you throw it?" And I said, "Lying, just a tad, probably 45 feet." This was in June, right when I hadn't thrown in 50 years, give or take. And he said,
"Are you a lefty now?"
No. And nor do I have fingers that are 8 inches long the way he does, right?
Yeah.
So, he says, "Levy, whatever you do, don't go to the mound. Right. Stand 30.
Yeah. That's right.
So
yeah.
I said, "How far would you have gone out to the mound?" He went out last time with the late Don Newcomb, who died this winter.
Yeah.
And he said, I can't repeat exactly what he said, but he said, "Hell, I wouldn't have gone out at all if it hadn't been for Nuke. Nuke needed me for support." But so I get out to them. I practice and I practice and I practice. And by the end of the summer, I could throw 60 feet, 6 inches. No kidding.
Wow.
I really could. And then I got a dead arm. And so I call Koufax back and I say, "Sandy, I think I've got a dead arm." And he goes, dead arm. "There's a really good Shiraz from Dead Arm, but it's a really big wine. Make sure you get a good vintage."
That is great. Okay, so you're a phenomenal writer.
Thank you.
I can go on and on about that. You're a phenomenal writer. Where did you learn to write? What were you reading as a child? Because most really good writers are incredibly broad-based readers. So what were you reading? What did you love as a kid?
Baseball cards.
Oh, wow.
Stuart Little.
Uh-huh.
Maybe. Maybe. Yeah, I guess I must have been a big reader, but I think I was reading things I wasn't supposed to be reading, like Henry Miller.
Yeah.
Something like that.
At what age, I can ask?
It wouldn't have been five. Wouldn't have been five. Maybe 10 or 12, something like
good
that.
For you.
I still have the copy with a little underlining.
The dog-eared pages.
Yes, the dog-eared
pages. Go to this page.
Did you go to a library?
Yeah, my mother actually was the chairman of the board at our local library, the William Cullen Bryant Library. And I remember very, very acutely sitting in the stacks, just all curled up with that smell of print, old print, the musty smell of old print. I don't know that you learned to be a writer. My dad, who the water boy, who later became an entertainment lawyer and represented really great writers like Joan Didion and John Donne and John
deal.
Le Carre. Yeah, like serious people. And then he had me. You know, I mean, he would always say to me if I complained about being, you know, blocked, he said, you know, he had no truck with that. He would just say, writers write, period.
Yeah.
If I repeated it again, but Dad, writers write. Mm-hmm. Get off your butt and write.
And that's what a lot of the really great writers seem to say. They always get asked those questions. You know, how do you ever? No, that's what you do. You get up, you do it. You're disciplined.
It's not always great. But
you have good days. You have bad days.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's why Red Smith, who was my hero, mentor, the columnist, great sports columnist, first for the Tribune in New York, and then the New York Times, would say he loved when back in the day when columnists wrote 7 days a week. Because he said, you know, so you'd have veal four times a week and turkey three times. And so you could get even.
Yeah.
Imagine writing 7 days a week.
No. I can barely get three.
Yeah.
Barely.
No, but think about what a lot of journalists, and I don't know if that's the right word to use, what they have to do now. It's 24/7. And it's not writing.
No, it's not.
It's not writing. It's reacting.
It's different.
It's tweeting.
I would think that our former colleague Shirley Povich probably wrote 7 days a week and sometimes twice a day.
Yes, I'm sure Shirley did. Wow. He also almost broke my neck.
Oh, well, how did that happen?
Okay. So, do tell.
Not like
79. 70, you know, he did 100 sit-ups and push-ups a day, right?
Right.
And so I'm driving him to Baltimore under the, it was a fatwa. George Solomon said, you'd get Shirley Povich to the Memorial Stadium on time for the ball game.
Get him to the Greek.
And I didn't know where I was going.
Oh.
I had never driven anywhere. I was new in the area. I was driving my new little red rabbit, I remember.
Oh,
and I got lost, and I was late, and I'm like, oh, my God, Shirley
Povich is
gone.
And you've got Shirley
is
right
gone,
next
and I've
to
got
you?
Shirley. And he's holding my shoulder. And he's squeezing my shoulder all the way up the Baltimore-Washington Parkway. By the time I got there, I could not move. So I do this gigantic U-turn in the middle of 34th Street with all the cops
and
the bands and everything. Do a U-ey, you know, burning rubber, open the door for Shirley. Cop comes and says, you're under arrest.
Oh, no. Because?
Because I mean, what I did was completely illegal. I said, yeah, but I had to get Shirley Povich here.
No, let him go. Just take me in.
So I locked the car in order to go out and talk. This is prescient, you know, it's Baltimore. I'm like, I've got to lock the door, and the key breaks off in the lock.
Oh.
And now I have
God.
To be towed.
Oh, God.
George doesn't know this story, by the
but
way.
But did Shirley go on and go into the park?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Shirley made the game, and he made his deadline.
Oh, my God. Okay.
You just did a little time.
many fast forwards. Again, I was talking to Ron before the show, and he says, oh, my God, Jane Levy, she's written all the best books on baseball, which you have. But whatever possessed you to go after Babe Ruth? Because there are books written about the books that are written about Babe Ruth, because there are so many and some good ones. But what inspired you to say, I've got to do it? And then it took a turn.
I think I had to be completely insane to agree to do it. It was the one thing after Mantle that I said I would never do, because what could you bring to Babe Ruth that hadn't been done?
So you've done Sandy Koufax, Mickey Mantle. And now Babe Ruth.
I call it my triptych. And, you know, I didn't want to do this. I took a year before signing the contract to read everything that had been written about him. And to be serious for a second, what was patently clear in all the books, as good as they are, and they're all quite good, is that there was nothing about the first 20 years of his life. It was as if he emerged fully fleshed in a Baltimore Orioles uniform in March 1914, you know, with no predicate.
Eating a hot dog and
eating a hot dog, riding a bicycle for the first time, going up and down in the elevator in Fayetteville, North Carolina, you know, having a swell old time. And, you know, as a reporter, and you guys know this, as a reporter, if there's something missing that consistently, there's a reason for it. And part of that reason was his desire not to have it written about. And existing at a time when you could say to reporters, don't write that.
Right.
You know, no problem, babe.
Yeah, they were complicit with the stars.
Totally complicit. Also, the documents that I was able to access, and I really hate using that as a verb, but the documents I was able to get because of the digital collections of material that are now available.
Commercial break. Apologies for the interruption. When anybody reads a book, you should always read the author's notes.
Sure.
They're so enlightening. No, most people I know don't.
Yeah.
But you read that, and it is fascinating because I think maybe somebody couldn't have done this book 20, 30 years ago, but now because of
digitization. One of the things that I found out that it was the thing that turned the switch, actually, was that his parents were divorced. You know, so this kid who is still referred to in the present as an orphan or as an incorrigible, which was a legal term, meaning that he had done bad and the courts had sent him away to St. Mary's Industrial School for Boys on the cusp of Western Baltimore. Neither of those things was true.
Right.
But in the absence of fact and in the absence of the ability to find those facts, people just kept repeating those two completely conflicting mythologies.
It was a very simplistic rags to riches.
Totally.
Yeah. And Babe never disputed that.
He got pissed off. Can I say that?
Yes.
He just did.
Yeah. Okay. He got pissed off and he would, you know, slam his hand on the desk and say, "I had parents." But then he never went any further.
Right.
Now, why would you? In that era, there was no 60 Minutes to go on, no Diane Sawyer to Linda.
No TMZ.
No.
Right. Can you imagine TMZ on Babe Ruth?
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
You know, to say, oh, you had such a hard time, you know, I understand now. So what you did is you shut up. You didn't brag that your father found your mother in a compromising position on what the documents refer to as the dinging room floor. That means dining room, by the way, with his bartender. And as soon as he found them together doing the thing, the nasty.
Cleaning the bar.
cleaning the floor of the dinging room, actually.
I have something I want to say about my husband.
You always do. You know, he had both of them arrested.
All right.
And she never returned to the family home except to come get her clothes, which she noted in his deposition he had just paid $45 for a new wardrobe for her because she had given birth to their last child the previous August, and I guess he figured she deserved and needed a new wardrobe. So she was just gone, and as soon as she was gone, the courts awarded him a divorce in May 1906 and custody of the three surviving children. Now, one of those three children was Babe Ruth. The other was a sister, Mamie, who was 6 years younger than he. And the third child that survived out of a reported eight, though I could only find six of them, was a little boy who died before his first birthday in August of 1906. And of the four children I could document who died, three died of starvation. You know, so by the time he's 7 years old and he gets sent away, he's seen the death of infant siblings. He's seen, you know, horrible loss. And then he is completely unwanted by either parent. They don't show up. They're just gone.
For years, correct?
His father never visited him.
And it's not like it was hundreds of miles away.
There was a streetcar that had that went right there.
Talk a little bit about St. Mary's.
Well, St. Mary's is a sort of Victorian-looking, very formidable institution with a lot of limestone and a big tower, and you know, and it was run by a lay order of Catholic brothers, the Zavarians, who were really actually very good guys, and they probably saved his life. Mm-hmm. But what they couldn't do was make him feel loved. Mm-hmm. And he lived with the with you know hundreds of others, abandoned, orphaned, incorrigible boys in overstuffed dorm rooms that were maybe made for 90 kids. Mm-hmm. They would sleep in pinstripe rows of wrought iron cots.
Head to toe.
Yeah. With just enough room between the rows to get down on your knees and say your prayers. Not a single personal artifact. Nobody had teddy bears there. Mm-hmm. They slept together. They ate together in silence, by the way. They bathed together to the extent that they bathed. And what he learned there was how to be public. He learned to share his life with a crew of boys, with a gang.
A team.
Yeah. And when they weren't, you know, asleep, they were out on the baseball field. Mm-hmm. And so he was the perfect person to become the first modern celebrity.
Yeah. And he sounds like, and then we'll move on from here, he was kind to the younger boys as he got older.
Oh,
and
totally.
He was probably a big man on campus, so it'll be, and he was kind to the younger
boys.
Yeah,
he bought them candy. You know, they earned money, actually, when they were learning a trade. He learned to be a tailor, and he could make a hell of a collar and cuffs. They were preparing him in case baseball didn't work out. And he was very fussy about that. You know, I mean, you don't mess with babes' colors. Mm-hmm. You know, so he would. They got paid a couple of cents for each shirt that they made. And that building that he worked in is still there. The Cal Ripken Foundation took over that building a couple of years ago, rescued the baseball field, albeit they put AstroTurf on it, and, you know, rescued it as a not just as a landmark, but as a place where kids in a very impoverished part of Baltimore can go and play a game.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you think he would have gone on to be as successful as he was in baseball if he hadn't been there?
No. I mean, he couldn't have been, because St. Mary's used baseball as a kind of way to channel, you know, a surfeit of male hormones.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was an organizing principle. So everybody played. From the time they were seven, they played. There were teams organized by shop, by floor, by last name, you name it. You have the book there. I don't. But there's a number of how many teams there were the last year he was there. It was extraordinary. And so he really got a chance to play. And there were coaches who were lay brothers who recognized his ability and pushed it.
Yeah, they really did push it.
It was like a farm system. Mm-hmm. It was really like a farm system. Mm-hmm. And while he's the only, there's only one Babe Ruth, so he's the only Babe Ruth to come out of there. There were a couple of other major leaguers and some minor leaguers that came out of there. It was really high quality baseball.
Yeah. So when did you know? I mean, you found this part of his life that nobody had really successfully navigated. And I always, in writing, and I know you feel, I'm sure you feel the same way, Gene, that sometimes you think you have enough, but you're not sure. And am I really telling this story accurately? So when did you realize, I got it. I know what happened to this kid between 7 and 19.
Probably it was during that first year when I went to interview his now deceased daughter, Julia, who died just a couple of weeks ago. And she was a very lovely, southern, inflected woman, even though she never lived in the South. Her mother did. Right? So, and very polite and pert and lovely and out of nowhere. And you guys, again, you know, it's not always brilliance that elicits, you know, the key piece of information. I don't remember what I asked. But suddenly she said, well, of course, Kate and George were separated. And I literally, jaw dropped.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, what? And she said, well, I just thought everybody knew. Well, of course, nobody knew. And from there, it didn't take a whole lot of smarts to go into the Maryland State Archives and type in George H. Ruth Sr. V. That was my big contribution. V. Katie Ruth. And up pops the entire file of the divorce. With the arrest records, with the depositions. I mean, George Sr. was not a lovely guy.
Mm-hmm.
Asked about his wife, he said, well, I guess she was all right when she wasn't drunk, but she was always drunk. She's lousy and the kids are lousy. So, I mean, this is what he came out of.
Yeah.
And to me, this sounds kind of, it's not funny and cool and whatever, but imagine being 7 years old and being sent away. Neither of your parents wants you either or visits you. I mean, Kate apparently came sometimes, but she was pretty sickly and she was apparently an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. And that ran in the family. And the repudiation and that sense, I'm unwanted.
Yeah.
Nobody wants me.
Didn't he say that? He was a little bit older, but he's at St. Mary's, and they never came to visit. And he said something to the effect of, to some of his buddies.
He said to Julia, there's a couple of phrases sometimes that just stick with you. I said, what did he tell you about St. Mary's? And she said, he said, and it was the only thing he said, I never felt full.
Oh.
And, I'm just like, he never felt full.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we're talking to Jane Levy. We're talking about this amazing book about Babe Ruth, the big fella, Babe Ruth and the world he created. The amount of research in this, I'm amazed it only took you, would you say 8 years?
Yeah,
I'm
but amazed. Now I have to have 2 cataract surgeries next week.
But the level of detail, somewhere in there you mentioned Marysville, Maryland, named after one of the last surviving members of the Donner Party. And this... Just goes right on.
Out of the clear
and then
sky.
About the Turnip Man, which caused me then go look up the Turnip Man. The amount. So I would say to anybody listening, if you love baseball, you love Babe Ruth, read this book because it's unlike anything else out there. And I did look at all the other books. But if you care about Baltimore at a fascinating time, absolutely fascinating time, or the rise of, and I'd love to hear you talk about this, the rise of sports journalism. He helped them. They helped him. It happened all at the same time. And as Jeannie was saying about agents, this all happened at the same time. It was remarkable.
He was an inadvertent revolutionary.
He
was anti-authoritarian in his soul for obvious reasons. But he had a better head on his shoulders, uneducated as he may have been, than people realize. In 1921, when he got fined and suspended by the then new first baseball commissioner, Kennesaw Mountain Landis.
He was a warm, friendly guy.
Oh, yeah.
He's a big hugging bear.
And he was trying to consolidate his power over the game. And he was also on the hot seat in Congress because he wouldn't give up his seat on the federal bench in Chicago. So he needed to distract everybody from that. Mm-hmm. And so what he does is he decides he's going to enforce this ridiculous rule that if you've been on a major league team, you may not go barnstorming after the World Series. Well, how stupid is that? It's typical of Major League Baseball. They haven't changed a hell of a lot, right? So, Babe Ruth says, well, gee, I think we're doing something good for baseball.
Which he did with Lou Gehrig, of all people.
Yes,
absolutely. Two of them.
Right. Yeah, later and the book is built around a 1927 barnstorming tour that they did together that started 2 days after the sweep of the Pirates in 1927. But the first tabloid newspaper was born in America in June 26th, I think, 1919, New York Daily News. It tells you how far journalism and newspapering has, floundered and foundered, that part of the key to the rise of tabloids was not just the voices of great sports writers like Damon Runyon and Paul Gallico and Marshall Hunt and blah, blah, blah. But
wrote the Poseidon Adventure.
Photographers who invented ways to capture action in a way that had never been done before. And now this year, what do we know? The entire photo department of the New York Daily News has been fired.
Yeah.
They don't need it. I mean, there's the century in a
just
figuring
out the transmission of photographs.
Right.
And using carrier pigeons originally to transmit some stories.
So that's my favorite picture in the book. There's a picture of him standing at the Polo Grounds in the fall of 1927 during a key series against the Cleveland Indians it's going to decide the pennant. And residents of the Upper East Side of Manhattan are desperate for information. And how are they going to get it? They either wait for the afternoon papers to drop, or they get a guy with a pigeon to fly back and forth from the Polo Grounds to their neighborhood with updates every inning. Now, that is the first year that a major league game was broadcast out of KDKA in Pittsburgh. But it would take a while for people, again, some of them were smarter than others. The Chicago owners got it. They started carrying their games on radio early in 1924. The Yankees, forget it. You know, they didn't get it. 1927, the World Series is carried coast to coast on two national networks, NBC and CBS. But they only carry one game opening day, with Babe Ruth sitting in a bunting-draped field box with Graham McNamee, who's just spoken to, you know, he was about to speak to the whole world for the long count fight.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
So the world, it was every bit as revolutionary a moment in technology as the era, the advent of personal computing was.
Mm-hmm.
And Ruth hired an agent, this Irish Catholic cheapskate who never took a drink and put a rose in his mother's grave every Sunday. Christy Walsh was the first sports agent. He's the model for Christy Walsh. I mean, for Jerry Maguire.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
He hires this guy who's a visionary. He sees that sports are entertainment and that Babe Ruth should be paid not just for the balls he hits out of ballparks, but for the tushies he brings into them. Mm-hmm. That's a radical new idea.
And make as much money off the field as he did on.
In 27, he becomes the first guy to earn as much money, $72,000 and change, compared to his $70,000 a year salary for the Yankees, which when you put them together comes out to something like $36 million in present-day money.
Mm-hmm. It's good money.
As I was reading about that, I thought to myself that Babe was as much a catalyst then as, say, LeBron is today, and that Christy Walsh was like a Scott Boras or a super agent, you know,
totally.
Which we don't give credit to, you know, how formative they were in where we are today with that celebrity aspect to sports.
Well, a Scott Boras really represents the money. And then a LeBron James has a publicist and ESPN and all these kinds of things. Christy did it all.
Christy
did
everything, including spin and damage control.
Right.
And believe me, there was a lot of damage
to
control. But he did it all. And the only thing he couldn't do was go into actual negotiations and argue on Babe Ruth's behalf with Jake Rupert, owner of the Yankees. So what he did instead is he did role-playing on a train leaving Los Angeles after Babe films his worst feature film. Or maybe it's not his worst, but there were only two, so it's hard to say. And they're in this little, you know, they're in the car, and Christy says, "Now I'm Jake, and I say, and what do you say?" And they rehearse the whole thing, and then Babe Ruth goes back to New York. Christy was putting out that Babe Ruth should be paid $150, which he certainly should have. He was never paid for what he did for baseball. He was hoping he would get 100. Babe Ruth settles for 70 immediately. Everybody in the world thinks this is so unbelievably overpaid. He was underpaid, just like Mike Trout is underpaid.
Right. Whatever number is, it's not enough.
Yeah, it's not enough.
Okay, last question for you, and then we'll take a break and come back with our deserted bedstand recommendations. How did your opinion of him change, if it did, after doing 8 years of this?
I like him more.
Uh-huh.
You know, the worst thing for a writer is to end up spending 8 years. I mean, I like to say I now hold a major league record
Absolutely.
For most consecutive nights spent alone with Babe Ruth.
Yeah.
Far more than either wife or both of them put together. And you don't want to spend that much time with a guy unless you like him.
Yeah.
I came to respect him enormously because his parents dumped him. They left him alone to create a life and a self, and God damn it, he did it.
Yeah.
You know, was he flawed? Did he find out that, you know, people, they're doing it today, you know, line up to screw Major League Baseball players? Yes, and to buy them drinks. Yes, and to overfeed them. Yes, what a shock.
Mm-hmm.
Remember what he said to his daughter? I never felt full.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he spent the rest of his life trying to fill up that void.
Yeah.
But what he made of himself, you know, and he did it on his own. I mean, Christy did a lot.
Yeah, I agree completely. I'm, you know, kind of the amateur knowledge of Babe Ruth. And I was kind of, a great player, what a bum, you know, kind of, whatever. And I read this and I think, my God, it's a miracle he lived, accomplished as much as he accomplished, and as many times as he screwed up. I just always kind of got the sense he's just trying. He's just trying to do the right thing. He's trying to get the job done, these kinds of things. Really, really remarkable.
And the end of his life, when baseball abandons him after he retires in June 1935 and they can't find a goddamn thing for him to do, is a complete recapitulation of his childhood.
Yes.
You know, he's been abandoned again by the institution.
I couldn't read those pages. I just kept flipping through them at the end because they couldn't find a single man in a job for
him. It is a shame for a guy that meant as much to that sport as anybody.
And there's no statue of Babe Ruth in New York, by the way. In Baltimore, yes.
Yes.
Right. Not in New York.
I mean, that's insane. It's insane.
Okay. It's really, really remarkable, Jane. Thank you so much.
Yes.
My
great
pleasure.
Book.
It's the big fella. Awesome. I really think the subhead or whatever what is it called?
It's called the subhead. It's called the subtitle.
Subtitle.
Thanks, Jeannie. Babe Ruth and the World He Created. People should read this. And if you have no interest in baseball, you should read this.
It's a remarkable time in history.
It's a fascinating story.
Famous American.
Yeah. Brilliantly written. Thank you, Jane.
Thank you so much.
I have one last question.
Sure.
Is there somebody that you're circling around to do the next one on?
We're not allowed to ask that question.
You're not allowed to?
I'm not allowed to ask the question.
I told her I wouldn't
answer. I'm sorry.
No. I mean, but who comes after Babe Ruth?
Freddie Patek? No.
The guy who chewed toothpicks in the infield. Remember that?
Sure.
81, right? No, it was the shortstop.
It was UL Washington.
UL Washington.
Yeah.
And I interviewed a dentist about what he was going to do to his gums.
He never, in the middle of a pitch. Yeah. There it was, just hanging out of his mouth.
He's masticating away.
Dusty Baker, same deal, right?
I don't think there's anybody.
It's hard. It can't
can
top
the
Babe.
After the Babe. No. I mean, who am I going to do? Cal Ripken?
Sammy Esposito?
I'd love to do Sammy Esposito. I was invited to his funeral.
Oh, wow.
They called me and invited me. Yeah.
How cool is that? I know. That's so great. Well, you don't need to write anybody else because you've done brilliantly.
You got the trilogy.
You've done brilliantly.
I'll think of something, but it may take a while.
As a lifelong baseball fan, thank you for the work that you've done.
Thank you so much.
Really terrific. Okay, take a break.
What is sitting on our bedstands not being read?
Not being read.
Yeah, we'll get to that next.
I moved mine. Take a break.
We'll be right back. It sounds tropical. But we're not on the deserted island anymore.
What's that really dreadful liqueur that comes in the white bottle? Coconut?
Curacao. Oh,
Malibu? No, Malibu rum?
Malibu, yeah, we'll get some of that.
You want some Malibu rum?
Okay. That is a sponsor.
We should have a yellow bird. I don't know it's in a yellow bird, but every time I was in the Caribbean, I drank yellow birds.
Oh, do you know blue Curacao was invented as, it was the reason you have blue Curacao, the liqueur, whatever, is because the Curacao Tourism Agency said we need something for people to think about when they come to our island, and so they dyed some liquor blue.
And there
There's
you go.
No, it's
when
not
I
like
was
it's
in Fort Lauderdale in 1983, I drank Barbadian rum that was 191 proof. So.
Was it Mount Gay? Deal with that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that'll get you there. That'll put hair on your chest, Lonnie. But now we are changing our focus from deserted island to books that are on our bedstand. And everybody has these. They're staring at you every night, and you might have good intentions. You might read
a paragraph.
Making
you feel guilty.
Yeah, and you're like, I'll get to this tomorrow. Tori, why don't you lead off?
I will start us off. Yes. And God bless him. I love Jake Tapper. He's a wonderful person. I used to know him quite well. I know him less well. He's a great guy. He's a good journalist. He's a hard worker. And he had a book come out, I think it's probably now close to a year ago, called The Hellfire Club.
Okay.
And it's a novel, but it's supposed to be wonderful. And I bought it the second it came out. Can't wait to read it. And it sat there until the last couple of days when I was coming up with this segment. I said, I can't look at that anymore. And I moved it. And for some reason.
Oh, you moved it. Now you feel better?
Yeah, I put it underneath and it's flipped over. So now I feel slightly less guilty. But everyone says The Hellfire Club is great. And I do believe it is being made into a movie.
There you go.
Okay.
That'll spare me from having to read it.
D.A.?
It's so... I always say ironic. And then somebody says, not ironic. And I think it's ironic. That we talked about with Jane, the notion of the newspaper industry, the sports journalism industry growing as a result of Babe Ruth. The book that I am interested in is called The Bully Pulpit that my wife gave me many years ago by Doris Kearns Goodwin, who it's a biography of Theodore Roosevelt and William Howard Taft, but it's ostensibly about them, but it's also about the growth of the journalism kind of industry, political journalism industry, which grew out of the muckrakers, yeah. if you remember those, that exposed corruption in the ruling class, Standard Oil and all those places. But how Roosevelt came to understand that the political press could be somebody that he could talk with about ideas, he could bounce things off of, they could be kind of his Greek chorus, for lack of a better term. And he really came to feel that this was an important part of his job when he was president.
But if you haven't read this book, how do you know so much?
Because I've read like three chapters.
You read the back cover.
No, I read three chapters of it. Good. But there's still like 400 pages to go.
So it stares at you every night. David,
good one.
Put down One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and read me. Jeannie?
So I know that I should be reading Don DeLillo. And I have had Underworld sitting on my table for
a few years.
I think it was, I just looked it up, I think it was 1997. Hello. It was published. And I'm serious.
It's still there.
You know what, honey? Take Marie Kondo's advice. Put your hands on it. Thank you. Thank it for the joy it didn't give you.
It's sort of like Gravity's Rainbow. It's the same thing. It's like, I know I should read it. I know I should get it. I know I should enjoy it. But I just cannot open that first page.
Jane's grabbing notebooks
That's
now.
So funny.
Yes. Jane, do you have a book on your bedstand?
I was just going to say, just read the short part of it called PAFCO at the Wall.
There you go. Okay.
Which is the description of the home run, the Bobby Thompson home run.
Sure.
Then you and can then feel like okay about yourself again.
Okay.
All right. That's sound counsel.
Michael? Michael? Do you have a book on your bedstand that you're not reading?
Sorry, this has actually been on my to-read list for about 15 years now since I read The Name of the Rose by Umberto Eco in high school.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so this is Foucault's Pendulum.
Hello.
And
oh,
yeah. I believe it's about a group of book editors who come up with a conspiracy plot that's going to tie together all these secret groups over the ages, and it actually attracts the attention of some of those groups who then start to act upon this. And one of the great, I guess, hurdles of Eco's writing is, I mean, it hits you in the face, and you need to stay with it. And I think I was too young to stay with it at the time, so that is
and now you
that
don't have
still
the time.
There.
Yeah, I think you're right. I did read that.
And I don't think this is Bootsy's bedtime reading either.
No, no, he'd love that.
Marie Kondo, everybody. Marie Kondo.
Yes.
Yeah. Stern.
You guys know I love George Orwell, but you really got to be ready to read George. Because a lot of times it's really not a lot of fun going on.
A lot of yucks.
Yeah.
It's a little Orwellian.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, to coin a phrase. And I have a copy of Homage to Catalonia, which is him talking about his experiences in the Spanish Civil War, which I also have another book that I need to read about the Spanish Civil War. And I know it's brilliant, and I love George Orwell so much. And it stares at me every night and says, this is not going to be a fun ride. You'll appreciate it at the end of it, but just dive in. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to see what's on TV. Let me just do that.
Every time we talk about whether it's Deserted Island Recommendation or this one, I think there's so much out there.
Oh, my God, yeah.
There is.
Not enough time. There's never enough time.
And I'm so stupid.
You guys know David Vondrilli, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Wonderful guy, brilliant guy. Do you know he wrote a really, really good book about the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire?
Yes.
The anniversary of which was today.
No kidding.
Yeah. Anniversary of today.
I bet that would be fascinating.
It's absolutely
building
fascinating.
The building is still there.
People say, and I went and read the reviews of his book, that it's one of the best social history books ever written. So maybe we should have him on. He's good.
Well, that would be good.
Like a plan.
Vondrilli, I'm trying to remember. He may have been an intern to Euros, an intern at the Post. I got to remember.
Oh, excellent.
May have been. I was like the last in.
He was a reporter, then he was style editor for
a
while.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Did politics.
And now he's writing an op-ed column.
Yeah.
You guys over at the Post seem to do pretty well with people over
okay.
there. You talented
they just
people
move
here.
Around. They just move around.
You got to survive. That's all I can say.
I guess that'll do it for us.
That'll do it for us. Thank you, Zach and the gang. Jane Levy,
thank you
fantastic.
So much.
Having you.
Don't
it really was.
Buy this book and read it, but buy all your books. They're
thanks
just
for
fantastic.
Saying my name right. I really appreciate
happy
it.
Happy to. And it's remarkable.
Yeah, and what do we have coming up next week?
What we have coming next, speaking of the Washington Post, we have Kyle Swenson of the Washington Post, who has written this amazing book called Good Kids, Bad City, which is about the longest wrong incarceration of two guys in prison.
Wow.
Really remarkable, very heavy duty. I saw the three of them on the Today Show a few weeks ago. Really, really remarkable and a really interesting guy.
That sounds fantastic.
And between now and then, go to CW. and see the guys and say Chatter 5.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Calvert Woodley.
And get and some also, of that Argentinian Malbec.
Yep, and come in here and watch opening day on Thursday and watch all the Sweet 16 games and the Great 8 games.
I might just come in Thursday afternoon. Just
yeah,
roll
just
right
be here
Sunday.
At Chatter, Corner of Wisconsin, and Jennifer. We're out of here, but we will see you guys next Monday at 5:30.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye. Thank you.
Thank you.